Welcome to Bridging the Gap. We are Alaskans discussing issues that divide us in order to find solutions that will unite us.
Welcome to Bridging the Gap. Today is the fourth in a series of panel discussions of Alaskans examining the issues that have divided us politically in turbulent times. My name is Pat Chesbrough, and I live in the Palmer area. The objective of the panel discussion is to derive, through questions posed to the participants, an understanding of the causes that have resulted in the current polarization of the American political discourse. Subsequent to achieving a satisfactory understanding of the causes, it is hoped that through further discussion, a strategy for positive interaction can be constructed that achieves respectful accommodation of each side toward the other. Paul Thomas of Trapper Creek has devised these discussions and usually moderates. Today, Paul is a participant as we discuss the behavior models that affect the current polarization. In addition to Mr. Thomas, our panel includes Charles Hayes and David Musgrave. Would the panel please introduce themselves?
Charles Hayes, live in Wasilla, been writing about this subject for a long, long time.
Paul Thomas, I'm from Trapper Creek, originally from Pennsylvania, and I believe in the model of group dynamics.
I'm Dave Musgrave. I live up by Hatcher Pass and near Palmer. I'm a retired professor from University of Alaska Fairbanks.
So Paul and Charles each propose a behavioral model. Today we will learn about the models and search for the ways they provide hope or challenge for bridging the gap. Paul, please briefly explain your model as it relates to political thought and action. On what theories do you base your model?
I base my model on the study of nature. I believe that throughout nature, we have different life forms that gather together and work together for survival. They form groups, and these groups have hierarchies. And I believe that humans also function in that way. And that is the determination of how our politics are structured in all groups, church groups, Boy Scout groups, playground groups, classrooms. And I think that an understanding of how groups function with the alpha and the hierarchy underneath that alpha person is very important for us to understand how things are working in this current and in the past, historically, the way things function politically.
Thank you. And Charles, please briefly explain your behavior model as it relates to political thought and action and the foundation of that.
There's a number of people I follow in this subject matter. Robert Sapolsky at Stanford University, Joshua Green at Harvard, Lisa Feldman Barrett at Northeastern, and Jonathan Haidt at New York University. Haidt offers what he calls a moral pillar theory, which consists of, he's profiled, you know, people all across the world and identified six continuums of behavior, or value, like from care and harm to fairness, cheating,
I think we get it. Do you want to just go further?
No, loyalty, betrayal, authority, subversion, sanctity, and degradation. And liberty and oppression, if I hadn't already said that. My short-term memory is so bad. If I try to take something from long-term memory and put it in short-term memory, I lose it.
Thank you. Dave, any comments on the models that have been proposed so far or ideas of how they relate to what's happening in politics and thought right now?
Not really. I've been looking at more of along the lines of how people relate to what's presented in terms of political discourse right now. So it's not really a behavior model, except that it applies to how people relate to, in particular, facts or non-facts.
So how does that, how do groups then, and the idea of the alpha, how does that relate to facts, non-facts issue?
It, perfectly. The group right now that is embracing the non-facts is the group that sees as its alpha male Donald Trump. And Donald Trump has been putting out all these non-facts, and the people who belong in that group are just swallowing it hook, line, and sinker. I have a neighbor who was just, she admitted yesterday, we had dinner the other night, and she admitted yesterday that she's a conspiracy theorist. And she was espousing all the things that Trump was saying about Hillary, you know, even continuing to talk about Hillary's emails as if that is a relevant issue. But the people who believe this non-fact thing are people who are in the group, and we call it Donald's base. And he is clearly their alpha, and anything he says is considered gospel by this group.
Charles, you want to respond to that?
Well, this moral pillar theory, you can discuss that without touching people's hot buttons, because any society without one of them is untenable. If you don't have caring, if you don't have fairness, if you don't have liberty, if you don't have authority, if you don't have loyalty, if you don't have sanctity, if you miss in any one of those, you know, you're in really bad shape. Liberals, by nature, in normal times, care mostly about the first three, about care, fairness, and liberty. Conservatives are more tribalistic, and they care more about loyalty, authority, and sanctity.
See, I believe everybody's tribalistic. I don't believe.
The whole world is tribalistic. That is our nature. We.
Did you say conservatives are more tribalistic than liberals?
Conservatives are more tribalistic than that. That's there's plenty of research on that. They are more tribalistic because they care more about in-group loyalty.
See, I would dispute that just based on the fact that Obama was certainly more liberal, but he had his supporters all the way, and I think they are just as tribalistic as Trump supporters are, as tribalistic towards Trump.
So, Dave, think about this conversation and your political discourse concerns. How does it gel?
Well, it kind of fits in because the discussion I saw actually in Mother Jones magazine on what are political facts and what are people, and they discussed it in terms of two groups of people that tend to one side. We all have both these within us, okay? It's just whether you lean one way or the other. And he put it in terms of hierarchical people versus egalitarian. Mm-hmm. And so the hierarchical, which might be people that are more aligned with the tribal type approach and looking to one particular person versus egalitarian, which are sort of more spread out. They take their facts from different areas. And so what this article was saying was that the hierarchical people tend to react to facts or non-facts based on their own tribe.
Or could be their interest, the interest of the people up in the hierarchy, too.
And what they were pointing out is that there is actually a biological basis for this in the mind, in the brain. And that had to, you know, they've done tests on these types of things. Where they hook people up to an MRI and look at which regions of the brains are activated by, and so they give them they'll give them facts, and they'll give two different groups of people, one that believe, let's just use climate for now, one to believe that in climate change, and those who don't. And so for those people that believe in climate change, if you give them a fact that doesn't fit with their worldview or their tribe, they're apt to react first in some limbic area of the brain. It fires off immediately. And the the portion of your brain that actually takes in and rationalizes or thinks about these areas of, in this case, climate change, that is a much more slow reasoning process. So your first reaction is a flight or fight reaction, and you don't even know that's going on. You have no idea that your brain is reacting in this tribalistic way. Maybe it's not the wrong word. It's
survivalist.
Survival.
Yes.
Survivalist way. You have no idea. And so even a political fact or non-fact brought up to you, argument, let's say, you react in a way that's flight or fight. Are you? If this is a threat to me, and it's a you feel it in your body. It's a physical threat, and it's only later on when you think about it in a thoughtful way that you can actually counteract that first reaction. So I find that very interesting.
So this is Bridging the Gap on Radio Free Palmer, KVRF. We're Alaskans discussing issues that separate us politically with the hope of creating bridges across that divide. And you were shaking your head, Charles. What do you have to add to what Dave said?
Well, I agree with what they were saying. We, in our limbic system, in the amygdala, we make decisions in milliseconds before it gets to our frontal cortex about things, about hierarchy, as a matter of fact. And we use the olfactory senses in making all sorts of assumptions that we don't even realize we've made. In a corporate setting, I used to, you know, when we had a large group of people, I would used to, we were all sitting around, I would tell everybody to freeze and look at their body language, and you can tell who relates to who, and we make these decisions without even knowing that we're doing it. But back to the notion of hierarchy, I mean, we are absolutely hierarchical, but conservatives put more stock in obedience to authority, in in-group loyalty, and sanctity, and purity. And by doing that, you've switched off to your identity. If what you're saying doesn't match their identity, they will tune you out, just like you said. Mm-hmm. Liberals, on the other hand, are more open to experience, more open to ideas, and they will try to discuss that without tying up their identity. I mean, although liberals are too, we identify with other liberals. But still, I agree with what you're saying about hierarchy, but I think you sort of have to take everybody's values into consideration, because you have to couch what your argument is in their value if you're going to do any good.
So, Paul, talk about the whole, how did Trump achieve being the alpha male? I mean, you talked about him being the alpha of this group.
He won a few primaries, first of all, and the thing that I think he did that most engendered his base to him was the way he was unabashedly insulting to anyone that they considered, that he considered his enemy. And therefore, that the admiration for him just went through the roof, because he was able to put down a lot of people that it's like when you watch a fight, and the person that you're rooting for in the fight, when they win, you're all happy. And that's how he achieved this alpha status. It's just the people were looking, and I take this group of people who are Trump supporters, and I go all the way back to Nixon. You know, Nixon had won the election against Senator McGovern, was the greatest landslide in the history of American politics, American elections. And then he had all these people behind him, and then 2 years later, he had to resign in disgrace. These people didn't go away. They stayed there someplace. And then they had a real rough time with Jimmy Carter as president. But boy, when Ronald Reagan came, oh, that was it. That was the saving grace. These people coalesced around him as a leadership. And he was clearly the alpha there of that group. And then we had George W. Bush, the thing that happened with him was that Ross Perot came in, and Ross Perot ended up being a leader who was taking a large portion, and subsequently we had Clinton as president for two terms. these people followed the George W. Bush. That's the group that they belong to, and they needed an alpha, and anything the W did, they were okay with, even though he and Cheney lied about the weapons of mass destruction, that was still okay. But when Trump came along, that was something that they all just really enamored themselves to, because his alpha status was the thing that they really appreciated, and the way he treats people is something that they think is just fine.
You agree, Dave?
Well, if I go back to actually along this lines of the hierarchical or egalitarian dichotomy, George Lakoff also had a lot to say about this in his book, Don't Think of an Elephant, where he discusses it. He's a linguist from University of California, Berkeley. And in 2004, he published that book where he was discussing how people react to political rhetoric. And he discussed it and how people shape their ideas and their political ideas. And his point was there's sort of on that sort of hierarchical and egalitarian. He put it in a different point of view. Either you think of a family. You can have a father figure in a family where he drives the discipline and everything else. And that's the father figure family. And he's very controlling in the family. It's a mentality that says you can pick yourself up by your bootstraps. You can get out there and do it. Whereas the nurturing family is more egalitarian. It's that you have to nurture people along. You have to protect your kids from these things, and so we all have this. I see it in myself when I'm with my family. I'm more the the authoritarian, whereas when I'm in a social situation, I'm more egalitarian.
So when you're in different groups, you have a different status in that hierarchy.
Well, that may be that, so my poor son takes it on the chin on this one. But his point was, based on your rhetoric, all you need is one or two words to trigger that portion, either the disciplinarian side or the egalitarian, the nurturing side. It's only one or two words. This is built in. This has come back to limbic. All you have to say is make America great again, okay? Mm-hmm. And that just it triggers. I mean, they see parts of the brain that light up on that. Right. And your reason goes out the window. So I think, and I'm not sure whether Trump does this intentionally or is he just good at it. You know, there are other, in the past with Obama, they have speechwriters and everything. As long as Trump is on script, he doesn't hit those same hot button issues that he does when he's off script. But he just has a knack and he's good at it.
I think he tested it with the birther movement. That birther movement went on for years and years, and that's where the perfection of that strategy occurred.
So it falls right in line with the whole dichotomy that Lakoff brings up.
Well, Lakoff's strict father figure feeds into the hierarchy thing, mm-hmm. but Trump is a bully. He's always been a bully. People are always characterizing him as some kind of a genius. You don't have to be a genius to appeal to people's worst instincts, and that's what he does. He knows how to get people to react. But when you're doing this, when you're reacting, you're relating. You're not reasoning. You tune out and you relate. So that's another aspect of this is a big part of Trump's base are people who don't know very much about what's going on. They don't understand politics. They don't understand civics. They just have a foggy notion about it. They don't feel a lack of responsibility because they don't know. But the fact that somebody can fix it that doesn't know any more than they do means that they're absolved from not having spent the time to figure it out.
So, this is Bridging the Gap on KVRF Radio Free Palmer. We're Alaskans discussing issues that separate us politically with the hope of creating bridges across that divide. So how does the fake news piece fit into this sense of identity that you're talking about, this experiential versus non-experiential? Is this just a wonderful idea that he has to say fake news over and over?
I just think that the group, that the people in this group are just willing to follow their alpha over the cliff. And it does not matter whether he says the truth or lies. They even say, oh, I voted for Trump. Yeah, I know he lies a lot, but I still voted for him. We've heard that coming out of the exit polls, people saying that. And I just think this is just groupthink, where they're following this alpha. And Donald Trump, his entire life, has been the alpha of the organizations that he has run. And he's very used to it. The type of government that he is pushing is not a democracy as much as it's a dictatorship. And he doesn't understand why Congress doesn't do exactly what he says, because he says something and it should be. And he gets angry with the Republicans whenever they don't follow through with what he wants.
So what is the, you know, as we think about this various ways, and what you've said is we're kind of hardwired to behave in these ways. Is that what you say? How do we fight it then?
Well, I think we first have to understand it. And, you know, so following on the lines of this Mother Jones article, they cited a number of different studies, social scientific studies on various aspects where they put people with predetermined point of views or in various situations, they give them false stories, basically. They don't tell them they're false, but they tell them, they give them a particular set of facts. And so that portion of people that are already predisposed to those facts latch onto them, regardless of whether they're true or not. And those people that are against it reject it. And
but they cite the source of the facts, right?
No, they just give them a false story. They just give them a false story, and they say, And then they'll say, well, okay, this story was not true. They sort source it afterwards, and the people. So originally, they tend to identify with the stuff they want to identify. You know, they're already in their comfort zone, and they identify with that. Even when you give them alternative facts, I mean real facts, saying this was wrong, we didn't tell you the truth, and give them the real facts. They still have a hard, they resist believing the new facts. They'll either reject it because they'll look for other facts that sort of bolster their point of view. They will go on a massive search in their brain to pull out all the files that will prove that fact is not wrong, or they'll attack the source. Oh, that person said that, but they're wrong. I don't trust that source.
So this is both sides then?
Both sides. Yeah. And what's interesting, well, consider what's in front of us now politically. There's climate change, there's the DACA, and a lot of these, which some of us scientists believe are fact. But there's a large part of Republicans that do not believe it's fact. However, look at the no-vaxxers. Those are mostly liberals, the no-vaccination group. And so they're denying science there also. So it's not relegated to one side or the other. And in fact, scientists are susceptible to this, very susceptible. That's why we have peer review. That is, when you go to present your point of view and your research, you may have a number of different biases already. We know we do. But the scientific review process, where it goes out to review it, a number of other scientists to come, maybe up to, if you try to publish an article, you'll be reviewed up to five different scientists that will weigh in and say, well, they didn't do this right. So that's an attempt to get people out of their own biases. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. Remember plate tectonics was first presented in the 1920s. And even when I was a graduate student, there were still some people that did not believe in plate tectonics.
So as we move forward, first of all, we have kind of not, I would say, conflicting behavior models, but two behavior models. What is the crossover between the two models from your perspective?
I don't see them as having a conflict. I just see them as components of the same thing. I mean, human behavior is incredibly complicated. Robert Sapolsky describes it as if you're going to judge somebody's action of what they have done, you have to take into consideration what's happened in their head 1 second before. Then you have to go back and think about it a month before. You have to go back to their childhood, their prenatal, and then you have to go back into primitive history to find out what evolved to make us take those things as an option. I mean, that we would do. It's incredibly complicated, but also we have an incredible capacity to change. I mean, and to change the whole culture we essentially have a chemical factory in our heads. We all the time equate our heads with a computer, but that's wrong. It's more like a gland. We have oxytocin and dopamine and vasopressin and adrenaline and going on all the time, and these things, you know, sort of take over our action, but we don't feel them. We don't know that's what's happening. But
so this capacity to change, you said, can you use some examples of that capacity?
Well, Sapolsky, there's a couple of ones with chimpanzees and ones with baboons, and we hierarchically we're pretty similar. We have some pretty similar to those groups. Well, a couple of instances, the alpha males in a baboon group ate poisoned meat, and it killed all the alpha males. And the society of baboons had been incredibly oppressive. I mean, hierarchical, dominant. I mean, you know, everybody goes downhill. You know, punishes everybody downhill. So once these alpha males were dead, the females and the moderate males took over and changed those cultures forever. I mean, generation after generation after generation were different. I mean, and the same thing happened to a group of chimpanzees.
That's precisely what I'm saying. Yeah, that is a perfect example of how when the leadership in the groups occur, that the direction will change in where those groups go. And I'm looking at the group, which is the United States of America, the citizens of the United States of America, how we were going all in one direction with George W. Bush. And then when Barack Obama came, even though there were a lot of policy things that remained the same, that the direction of the country went in a more, I don't know, just manner. I just feel that a lot of things would happen with the gay rights and other rights and immigrant rights and things like that. Not fully as far as maybe some people would hope, but the direction did change with Obama. And then when Trump took over, boy, it just went in the totally opposite direction. We are still the group that is the citizens of the United States of America. And that group now is looked at by the rest of the world fearfully because of the leadership now that is in the White House.
So did it really change then would be my question, or did it serve to allow the fears of people who felt that Americanism was different, our identity was being harmed by these other groups, the whole issue of unemployment and, you know, income inequity and those kinds of things. Did it change, or was it there and sort of suppressed for that time? Did we have time for it to change? Dave, what do you think?
I think it was always there, and I think during the recent administration and during the election that he was able to hit people's, grab people's attention, because it always has been there. But I don't know, you know, I hearken back to I forget the lady's, the author of this book, and she did a study down in Louisiana. It wasn't really a social, but she just interviewed a lot of people, so it wasn't a real scientific study. But she, her premise was, and the analogy she used was that a lot of the people that voted for Trump in Alabama in particular, felt like they were in a line all the time. They were in this long line, and they were at the back of, when Obama came along, it wasn't that they were racist or anything. It's just that he said, oh, well, I'm going to let the immigrants go first. I'm going to let the people of color go first. And these people, you know, so to use the same analogy, they felt like people were cutting in line in front of them. And I can understand that analogy. I didn't understand the election, the results. But when she put it in those terms, I went, yeah, I can see that. It's not that they were racist necessarily. It was that, you know, as a group as a whole, I mean, I'm sure there were some racists that voted for Trump. I'm sure there were racists that voted.
They lost some status.
Yeah, they've been waiting for a long time. This class of white Americans have been losing ground for a long time, and we know that. And when they saw somebody come in, President Obama say, okay, I'm going to give preferential treatment to the LGBT community. I'm going to give they felt like, okay, they're cutting in line. I can understand that analogy.
So this is Bridging the Gap on KVRF, Radio Free Palmer, and we are Alaskans discussing issues that separate us politically with the hope of creating bridges across that divide. So do you also feel that, Paul, that perhaps people that we've just described don't feel like those people are part of their group or will ever be part of their group?
No, I think everybody belongs to groups, belongs to different kinds of groups.
I mean, the group of Americans, whatever. I mean, the people
there's subgroups, like the group that is the citizens of the United States of America is one large group. An even larger group is all the people that reside on this planet. But they could be subdivided into smaller groups. Trump's base is a subgroup of the citizenry. Liberals who vote Democratic are a subgroup of the citizenry in the United States. Does that answer your question?
We are so groupish, tribalistic as a species that you can put everybody in a room and give them a colored hat, and the first thing you know, they'll be sitting with the same hat colors. I mean, I just read a piece this morning about the movie Planet of the Apes when Charlton Heston came out there years ago. Mm-hmm. They noticed after a while that the chimps and the gorillas were all eating lunch together.
In the movie or the actors?
On the set.
Yeah.
So what you're saying is we group ourselves, yeah, even if in small arrangements.
Right.
You know, if you're in a classroom and everybody always sits in the same place after the first day, everybody sits in the same place from then on.
Right.
So we tend to want to.
Right. And there's another missing piece that's related, I mean, by our behavior big time, and that's having a common enemy. When we had the common enemy of the Cold War, it pulled us together to be against somebody. When that wall went down, we started looking around and then the LBGT and all of that stuff.
The two groups at that time were the communists and the rest of the world, free world.
Right.
Okay. Now we have the groups that are the Muslim terrorists and the Western world.
Right. I knew when the Berlin Wall came down that people would start putting it back up in a period of time when enough strangers came into their country, and that's what happened to Brexit.
Now, the funny thing about that history is that the Berlin Wall came down because Gorbachev, who was the alpha of the Soviet Union at the time, allowed this more egalitarian society to emerge in Russia. And so that ended up being the breakup of the Soviet Union. But subsequent to that, when the Soviet Union broke up, Yeltsin became the president of Russia. He was the mayor of Moscow, became the president of Russia. But he was such a buffoon that what he had to do was he had to get a security chief to keep him out of trouble because they were coming after him for the corruption. That security chief happened to be Putin. And then once he declared Putin his heir apparent, Putin, who was a very strong alpha male, managed to secure his power base. And now he's worth over $200 billion. In the no longer the communist Russia, but the oligarchical economy of Russia.
So is Angela Merkel now the alpha person in political in the world?
I believe she is.
She's the voice of reason.
I believe she is because she supplanted Trump. She supplanted Trump. Even though the United States is way more powerful, I believe Angela Merkel is now the alpha of the Western world.
Well, do you think that Lakoff's ideas about using language to elicit a response from people Do you think that has anything to do with tribalism? I mean, if you say just a few words like make America great again, that puts you into a tribe right away. If that hits your particular button, you're going to go, okay, I'm a Trumper now.
Black Lives Matter, another example.
Yeah,
on
exactly.
The other side, yeah.
Lakoff's best book, his best work is Philosophy in the Flesh. And that's all about language. It's all about metaphor. Mm. It's all about how we create a whole reality with these things. And
Orwell did the same thing with 1984 with his speech.
Philosophy in the Flesh is an incredible book. It's a game changer up here.
Hmm. I'd like to say one more thing before we run out of time here about how I feel based on this model that totalitarian societies occur. I believe that in any group where the mission of that group is that the male, alpha male status is the most important aspect, like we had in Hitler's Germany, where Hitler's Führer had to be the most important thing. Stalin's Russia was also totalitarian. When the alpha's status is the most important aspect of the group, then that society becomes totalitarian.
Right. But another big part is social media is retribalizing us in this aspect. When you get a group of like-minded people together, you run into ideological amplification, which simply means that they go further in the direction that they were headed when they started a group. And now we have thousands of groups on Facebook who get together every day and double down on each other, bonding to be more like what they wanted to be when they started the group.
Clearly, Facebook is a subset. There's a subgroup.
A feeding frenzy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We just get further and further and further divided.
I mean, we're seeing that demographically also. So people are moving to communities that look like them politically, which is not the way it was when I grew up.
I double down on it every day myself.
Yep.
trying to find people that are like-minded. This is Bridging the Gap. I'm KVRF, Radio Free Palmer, and we are Alaskans discussing issues that separate us politically with the hope of creating bridges across that divide. Now, let's talk about those bridges then. So we've talked about the kinds of things that divide us. What will it take to change the path here? Obama tried for 8 years. It's almost gotten worse than when we started. Dave, what can we do?
Well, language is a big part of it. For example, there was a study on climate change. And when asking people that were climate deniers, let's just put quotes around that because it's easy to say. I don't have to go through a whole paragraph. When they were confronted with facts and facts were presented to them and somebody said, well, we need to change our use of fossil fuels and reduce the impact on climate through fossil fuels. And versus, we could actually reduce our reliance on fossil fuels by using nuclear energy. If they use that language instead of just stop all fossil fuels, the side that was against climate deniers, they were more amenable to moving in that direction because they could understand nuclear, it's sort of pro-development type thing. So it was sort of, they could understand that language because they were used to it. And so language is a big part of it.
My answer to that is it's going to be very tough get the gap bridged unless we have a leader that each side can relate to. Clearly, Obama was not that guy, even though his rhetoric, I think, was very amenable to both sides. It's just he was a black man, and there were people that just were not going to be able to ever accept a black man as their alpha. We need somebody that is going to show that they can be the leader of both ideologies. I don't have any other better word than that.
Well, if you use the moral pillar theory, And liberals, like I said, care about care and fairness. And you want to argue with a conservative who cares more about loyalty and authority and sanctity. What I do is take my fairness issue, I'll use member of the armed services because that gets into their territory. I'll talk about being unfair to a medical family of somebody in the armed services because that hits all of their buttons. So they can relate to that.
Colin Powell. That's the name that pops out that has the authority from his time in the military and also is a very thoughtful, fair person. Yeah, so that would stick out. And I think if we have a leader like that who would manage to ascend, I think that probably would do more than anything else to bridge the gap.
Do you think if we tried to have leaders at other positions that would help as well? Does it have to be the president? Could it be 50 governors? Could it be 100 senators? Could it be?
I think we already see it in successful organizations. We have leaders that are able to run those organizations because they embrace all these things in your moral pillar, as well as maintaining their authority to do that. And I think that organizational structure is highly successful. And if we had more of that, I do believe, both in government and in industry, that we would have a better situation than what we have now.
Well, if we take it on a much more local level, and the most local level is within our own skin. I was reading an article by another, I forget his name right now, but he realized this whole process where you have this flight or fight reaction to anything that you that is against your philosophy or your general culture or anything. And realizing that, he actually tried to change what got in and what he would able to be to think about in a rational sense. And he said it was so hard. He said he had to do it on a daily basis. That if he was presented with information that was new to him that he disagreed with, even though it may be true, he had to wait 10 minutes and just let it sort through, not fight it, just let it settle in. Now, I don't know, hold a whole lot of hope that everybody's going to do this in the United States or the world, but if you really want to open yourself up to new facts, and I've tried this, and I can see it. I can just see personally how I react physically to something that I initially don't believe in, and then although I'm presented with clear facts, it's like, just let it settle. So on a personal level, it's very difficult, but maybe it can be done. This guy was skeptical whether he would be able to do it for himself.
He wanted to do it, though.
He wanted
that. You have to have the will to do this.
Oh. Well, and what? So you're working with Indivisible Alaska right now. So how is that bridging the gap, or not?
It's not. It's not. I use Lakoff's ideas to hit people because we're on social media. And that's how you get people. So I find myself in a difficult position.
So you're gathering a group together.
I'm trying to keep a group together and keep them motivated.
Identity. Yeah, interesting. Paul, what have you done specifically to bridge the gap in your life besides this?
Well, yeah, this I was going to say. you know what? I have, like, for the most part, observed. Well, one of the things I wrote my book, My Referendum Machine, because this was back in the 80s, I felt that if I'm going to complain about the government, and I was very upset with the government at that time, Reagan was president, I didn't like the way things were going. If I was going to complain about it, I should have some ideas on how to fix it. And thus, I wrote the Referendum Machine as a way to, and I was basically looking at that as liberals and conservatives. And the first thing I said in that book was that I really don't think that liberals and conservatives are a fair way to judge how we are believing as far as our society, because it's basically a circle, that you can be so far to the left as Stalin was, and you can be so far to the right as Hitler and Mussolini were, that you end up having this exact same type of society, which is the totalitarian society. So I haven't really done that much as far as bridging the gap, mainly because I didn't see the danger until Trump came on the scene and he started winning those Republican primaries. Then I saw the danger. And then after that, I started taking my guitar to the Egan dinners and playing music for the Democratic functions. And that's kind of like I was going to help that.
Well, to me, to have a hope of bridging the gap, you have to bring people together who care more about a solution of something at hand than they do about whose side that wins. And if you can convince them to do that, if you can convince them that this problem is so hard and it needs a solution so bad, if you don't care who wins and we can solve it, I think you have a chance, a shot at it.
We want a better society, not someone that just wins all the time.
Right.
I agree.
Well, but one of the things that Trump has done, what is Make America Great Again, is everyone gets to determine for him or herself what that means. What is great America? He never defines that. So can we coalesce around words like that and actually define what that means to each other? Is there a way to take the emotional appeal?
My ideas aren't going to be the same as Trump's, because a great America is a tolerant America where economic justice can occur. And economic justice includes affordability for the things that we need to buy. If you're willing to work a job, you ought to be able to afford your house, your food, getting your kids educated. And it also involves accountability. And we don't have either of those in our current political and economic system.
So this is Bridging the Gap on KVRF, Radio Free Palmer. We're Alaskans discussing issues that separate us politically with the hope of creating bridges across that divide. As we move forward, we're saying that this is really difficult, and we're saying that we maybe have more things working against us than for us. What can we eliminate that would help us to move forward? What can we eliminate?
Well, our greatest enemy now is not the Cold War. Our greatest enemy now is ignorance. One of the things Trump has done is he has awakened a whole bunch of liberals. And to me, we just need to increase the size of the choir.
So you think that Trump has gotten the resistance to Trump activated?
I think so and hope so. I mean, It seems more I went through, well, we're old enough here to have gone through years when liberals didn't say much about anything, just kept quiet, and the conservatives held the public forum, all the letters to the editors, nobody would speak up on the kind of liberals. That's not the case anymore.
Yeah, well, you know, you brought up Indivisible Alaska. That's a local or statewide group that is in response to the election of Trump. And it was actually started at the national level by the Indivisible group. And their parameters were, and the Indivisible group was started by a couple of congressional staffers that saw how well the Tea Party movement in the 2010s and so forth worked. And so they said, we can use these same tactics now to oppose the Trump agenda. And so
they opposed the Obama agenda.
I would not say that this is bridging the gap anymore. So this is two sides. There's just to use the dichotomy again, we have the Tea Party on one side and we have the Indivisible on the other side. And I'm not,
winning. That's about winning than bridging the gap.
Yeah, or protecting what you think you need to be. What you think you
need
to protect.
You know what we say about liberals all the time, that we bring knives to gunfights.
Mm-hmm. Well, but let's go back to the comment about ignorance, because I think that I wonder whether saying things like that is actually the antithesis of what we're trying to accomplish. How do we not imply that people are deficient in some way in order to move us together?
We can recognize the ignorance, but we don't need to shout it from the mountaintops. And what we need to do when we do recognize that ignorance is to respectfully attempt to educate. And if we use respect in that attempt, we have a lot better shot at making it work than if we say derogatory things or pejorative things to them and about them.
We all know Trump supporters who are really nice, decent people. They just are confused by a bunch of mistaken assumptions that they take for reality, and they would give you the shirt off their back if you asked for it.
Yeah, I think ignorance is a pejorative term, and I'm reluctant to use that, especially when discussing bridging the gap. Again, on the climate change issue, they had two sets of groups: educated Republicans, you know, very well educated Republicans, and some that weren't. And when these Republicans were presented, the two different groups were presented with actual facts about climate change, the ones that were the most educated had, 19% agreement with that fact, whereas those that were not educated agreed with it 31%. So education seems to argue in this particular case against accepting facts.
That is an incredible result.
It is an incredible result.
An incredible result.
So, again, being educated, and again, I think we can say when we say things like we have to educate people, I think that can be a pejorative term, too. We just said, we talked about this ignorance thing. We talked about being ignorant of our own biases, our own willingness to let things go.
Maybe blind's a better word.
Yeah. So it's an interesting dilemma, I think, that we face as we consider that we may believe that we have some information that others don't have, and if they only had the information. So how do we get there? And to a question, a more specific question that Mike has proposed is, does the healthcare process, as championed by Lisa Murkowski, perhaps by John McCain, does any bipartisan process have a chance right now in the current situation here in our country?
Had Patty Murray and Lamar Alexander all hunkered down and working together for a couple of weeks. They said they had some progress. But Lindsey Graham and Mr. Cassidy decided to blow that up. And what got me was Lamar Alexander just caving into them right away. Whenever they had a bipartisan activity already underway that looks like it might have done something, but I think in that case it was more about winning. They had to defeat Obamacare. Obama is not completely defeated until Obamacare is completely defeated. Because Obama didn't really lose any elections, from my recollection.
So do we have a chance?
On that particular issue, remember our own senator was on that committee, on the HELP committee. And I believe Susan Cullen was too. Mm-hmm. Was she? On the HELP committee?
On the bipartisan committee? The Murray Alexander committee?
That's the Health, Education, Labor, and Pension committee.
Right. The woman from New Hampshire was, for sure.
Okay. So, I don't think it was just Alexander that blew it up. I think the Republicans. And so we haven't heard from Senator Murkowski whether she was part of that contingent of Republicans said, no way, we're not going to bring this forward until we're done with Graham Cassidy bill. So we don't know that.
But you had some information on that earlier, Pat, didn't you? About how they stopped the vote?
No, this is last week. Yeah. This is last week when the Alexander Murray bill was finally, or the bipartisan plan they were working on, they just said, we're not going to bring this forward. We stop because Graham Cassidy is moving forward. This was last week.
And one of the things I heard that Lisa Murkowski just said about this process, which is apparently they've pulled the bill at this point in time, that it was a lousy process. So again, I think she's trying to push that forward. But I read an essay from this person named Marcelo Gleiser, who is a physicist and so on in Dartmouth, and he said, to belong to the tribe means protection from outside aggressors and an immediate sense of identity. I'm part of a group that shares my values. Being part of this group makes me strong. Those who are not part of my group that don't share my values are a threat. They are the enemy. If we don't destroy them, they will destroy us. We thus must convert ourselves to our values, others to our value system, or if that fails, destroy them by any means available. Does this describe Congress right now?
Pretty much. If we can't break Big Pharma and the insurance companies' hold on Congress, nothing's going to get done that's going to benefit the average citizen over the industry. Nothing.
So you're saying that the corporation, specifically this Big Pharma, is part of the group of the people that are fighting this.
They play the music to which the group dances to.
So that the identity is money, then? The sense of identity is money? The value is money?
The value is being reelected.
Mm.
Yeah, I agree that the Democrats and the Republicans are definitely structured in groups. And the most important thing is what your essay alluded to, which was winning and destroying the enemy. And they really thought with this 2016 presidential election, where they had both the House and the Senate and the White House and the Supreme Court, that they really thought that they had achieved their ascendancy. But as it turned out, that there were a few people out of that Republican group that cared more about America than cared about the Republicans achieving a great victory.
If you've been watching the Vietnam thing on television.
It's riveting, yes.
Right. Okay, the same thing in the way that they're applying the power of the war and to be reelected, the same thing right now is occurring in healthcare. The exact same thing. They're trying to maintain power by...
Then they had to fight communism. Now we have to fight Obamacare.
They were told they had to fight communism,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
At least. So, any last quick statement, Paul or Dave? No? Paul?
Thank you for doing such a great job of hosting this discussion.
You're welcome. Charles?
No, I'm good.
We're good. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Bridging the Gap. We welcome diversified perspectives. If you are interested in becoming a panelist for a future show, send us an email to manager@radiofreepalmer.org.
This program is a production of Radio Free Palmer, recorded at our studios in Palmer, Alaska. The views and opinions of moderators and guests do not necessarily represent those of Radio Free Palmer, the station, or its underwriters.